We're about to meet a mythical character known as a kobold, described as a mischievous spirit from German folklore. A kobold often inhabits underground spaces, caves, or mines. A kobold is a kind of trickster figure who can be both helpful and aggressive and destructive. And the tension in the kobold's makeup can serve as a metaphor for ways in which the world of anthracite coal mining has been portrayed for nearly a century and a half by artists, illustrators, authors, photographers, and others seeking to capture something of the spirit of the industry and its people. First, an overview. While 19th century investors in the anthracite industry utilized survey drawings and documentary photographs to inform and record their expanding operations, public consumers of newly marketed anthracite products were also interested in visual representations of mining practices and events. Coinciding with the expansion of printing and publishing technologies, this popular curiosity was soon addressed in national illustrated periodicals, including Harper's Weekly and Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper. Both companies employed staff artists to make on-site sketches of intriguing people, places, and things, which were then transferred to printing blocks in art departments and published as wood engravings in widely circulated periodicals. Just as scenes of anthracite landscapes in painting indicated discrepancies between concepts of pristine nature and industrial progress, depictions of mining subjects in popular illustrations revealed tensions between ideals of productive work and fears of labor conflict. Mining was a profitable yet dangerous process, and miners possessing the mental and physical strength for hard manual work were also capable of demanding better employment conditions and higher pay. Perceptions of these issues by artists, authors, and audiences varied and were determined at least in part by whether individuals lived and worked within or beyond the anthracite regions. Born in Boston in 1842, Charles Green Bush represented contradictions of anthracite labor in a Harper's Weekly illustration of The Coal Miner at Work, published with an article discussing the production and sale of coal at state, national, and international levels. The image was accompanied by a scene of coal boats on the Delaware and Hudson Canal. The miner depicted is not identified in relation to any company or location, but is a personification of his own intensive activity. Echoing the folkloric figure of the kobold, the miner is shown as a powerful, primal mannequin, compressed and animated by the latent geological energy of the earth itself. Dark and burly, he wears an oil-burning lamp on his forehead. Dimly lit, his bearded features are wreathed in smoke and revealed by flame. He strikes the coal with his pickaxe, carving a void that resounds with knocking towards the distant surface and into the subterranean deep. His work produces fuel that heats homes and powers progress for the benefit of civilization, yet the miner, like the kobold, can harbor malevolent force. He should not, yet he must be trusted with the strength that he wields. That from an essay by Richard Stanislaus and Darlene Miller Lanning titled The Anthracite Coal Industry of Northeastern Pennsylvania, Selected Representations in Art, 1829 through 1959, in a catalog for an exhibition of paintings, sculptures, and works on paper from public and private collections that is opened at the Hope Horn Gallery at the University of Scranton, running through December 12th. There will be an opening reception and gallery talk this Friday, October 24th, and the public is invited to attend. Richard Stanislaus, artist and collector, is guest curator of this exhibit. Chester Kalesa is retired Historic Site Administrator of the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission, Anthracite Heritage Museum, and Scranton Iron Furnaces, and guest essayist for the catalog of this show. And Arlene Miller-Lanning is Director of the Hope Horn Gallery at the University of Scranton. They paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the exhibition in what is the first part of a two-part conversation. Dr. Miller-Lanning.
The project that we have for academic year 2025-2026, fall and spring, is a set of paired exhibitions. The main title is The Anthracite Coal Industry of Northeastern Pennsylvania. So there are two shows. The fall show is selected paintings, sculptures, and works on paper from public and private collections, 1829 to 1959. And that provides kind of a historical survey of representations of the anthracite industry over roughly 150 years. And then in the spring, there is another co-exhibition subtitled Selected Prints, Drawings, and Watercolors from the Stanislaus Collection, 1933 to 1946. And many of those images are prints related to the WPA, so works that come out of the 1930s. Mm. So that's a more focused exhibition on a subset of images within that broader overview. The project also has three receptions associated with it, one early in the first show, and Richard Stanislaus will be speaking with us on the anthracite coal industry in that 1829-1959 kind of time frame. We have a presentation by David Lembeck, who is a guest speaker who will be talking particularly on WPA post office murals in relation to that show. And then in the springtime, we're going to have a panel discussion with Richard Stanislaus, Chester Kalesa, and Peter Hoffer about the WPA prints and printmaking and some of the aspects of that related to collecting as well as history and the process of printmaking as an artistic process. So all of that is kind of summed up in a two-catalog project that we have. So there are a lot of really nice things happening. So the idea of the show, it's a selection of works, but there are things that are in the show, there are things that are in the catalog, there are things that are in the community in northeastern Pennsylvania. So there are works of public art that exist beyond what I can do in the gallery. And so the catalog and the lectures are kind of a bridge to that. So you can see things in the gallery, but you can also get information that would take you out into the community and see additional works.
And the wonderful thing is that you all have been working together over the years, and you, Chester, and you, Richard, have had a chance to work with each other at the Anthracite Heritage Museum in McDade Park. Tell us a little bit about that as an institution. It's not an art museum per se.
Well, it's one of the largest history museums in northeastern Pennsylvania, and I'm proud to say that when you walk in the lobby, the cornerstone is 1975. So this year, the Pennsylvania Anthracite Heritage Museum is celebrating its 50th year, and I've been a volunteer, a staff member, now a volunteer again at the museum. So it's been a pleasure to be part of that experience, and I notice now that your WVIA members will be coming to visit in November, both the Pennsylvania Anthracite Heritage Museum and the Lackawanna Coal Mine Tour, which I think is a great combination. And the fact that we now have this exhibition at the Hope Horn Gallery that people can visit, you'll see a concentrated selection of anthracite art history at the Hope Horn Gallery, and then some of the historical artifacts and photographs at the Pennsylvania Anthracite Heritage Museum.
Richard, how did you get drawn to the art of the anthracite region? You have been a specialist of John Willard Rott,
the distinguished Pennsylvania landscape painter. It was like anyone else being taken to the Everhart Museum as a boy with my parents and seeing some of the artworks and other things that were on display. And that kind of stuck with me. And then hearing a little bit about my grandfathers, both who were anthracite coal miners in the 20s, 30s, into the, actually the 50s. And as a child, believe it or not, playing with other children in some of the abandoned coal collieries in North Scranton. And one was the Leggett's Creek. And so on. And there were other ones as well. And also the Marvin as well. But I saw that later, more as an adult. So what started it kind of was when I was able to go to New York City and I went to a fair of prints. And there were many dealers there, and I met one dealer that I remember distinctly, Susan Teller, who had a gallery in New York City. And I mentioned to her, do you have anything on the coal industry? And to my surprise, she opened up a portfolio, and there in the portfolio were some graphics of anthracite coal seams from the 30s, which I was really surprised to see that. I didn't even know about their existence. And that kind of started it, but it was through her kindness, her education, her patience, and also she let me pay for it on layaway. So I was able to acquire Coffee Break from Riva Helfand, a distinguished printmaker.
When we're hearing this from Richard and hearing this from Chester, what role do they play as people from this region who care about the material culture, particularly with Chester, and the art with Richard?
They have a connection to it, and they try to interpret it in a sincere and insightful way, not just as a list of facts and figures. There is a real kind of personal value, I think, that's invested in it. So it's been my privilege to work with Richard and Chester for over 30 years. And this exhibition has its roots in an earlier show that Richard had done as the curator at the then Wyoming Historical and Geological Society. They are now the Luzerne County Historical Society. That was presented in 1996 and was one of the people who were, you know, closely connected with it was F. Charles Petrillo. Mm. So we acknowledge him. We've just lost him recently. So there's a long-standing community interest in the subject, and there are people who feel the importance of carrying that forward. And over the decades, as you know, the generations shift, some of those memories are less immediate and less connected directly to family members. I had a grandfather who worked in the mines. There was a time when a large number of people could say that. Now, my son's generation and generations going forward, that becomes more and more remote. So there is an importance to trying to record that legacy as long as there is sort of a living link to those memories.
Richard, we know you could give us volumes of information about John Willard Rott, but tell us something. Give us a brief introduction.
Well, a little bit would be a distinguished Pennsylvania landscape painter, born in the 19th century, 1857, and then died in 1931, but was trained at the National Academy of Design in New York City, and then went on to Paris, France, which at that time was the center for artistic training, and a great deal of Americans went there as well to study at the different academies, and he studied at the Académie Julian. And there were prestigious students there as well with him. And his love, though, after, you know, getting his academic training, which was extensive, his love, though, was the moods and the colorations and the changes of the natural landscape. So he decided to pursue landscape painting as a career. And the Everhart in Scranton, PA, at Nayog Park, does have a good representative collection of his works. There's quite a number. And we are also happy to be able to have that Rott show at the Hopehorn Gallery and to do the academic scholarly work of the three catalogs that came from that. And that's through the Hopehorn Gallery and the exhibit. And I have to say, with the exhibit opening, that gallery was packed. It was packed with people. So there's a lot of people admire his work. And his respect for his memory and so on. But I would say that he was well loved during his lifetime. He really was. And I had the good fortune to interview at least two people, possibly three, that remembered him alive. This is over 50 years ago. Imagine that continuation, you know, of history and of communication and so on. And that was a real pleasure. And it was William Quinn at the Fidelity Bank in Dunmore, who called me about Rott. And I said, Mr. Quinn, how did you know about him? Oh, I waited on him as a teller at the old bank in downtown Dunmore. Hmm. And I said, what do you remember most? And he said, he wasn't talkative. He was always in a business suit, a dark business suit. He had pince-nez glasses and so on. I said, what about his estate? Oh, no, he didn't really have much. But what he did, though, was this. His star, his riches were the pursuit of his creativity and his art.
So many people don't get to do that, as we know. Chester, what have you observed about John Willard Rought and his work?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, through Richard and Darlene, I'm familiar with the work of Rought. And in fact, you mentioned the Pennsylvania Anthracite Heritage Museum. There is a work also at the museum as well in that collection. And I think what is so special about working with both Darlene and Richard is that they are fundamentally both artists. They're practicing artists, so they understand the work of artists. They understand the creative process. So working with them on this anthracite art history has been very educational for me because I'm not an artist, so I'm learning from them and in pursuit of education, understanding knowledge.
And we all can in that way. Darlene, you mentioned George Lukes, and that's a name that is known outside the area. Tell us a little bit about him.
I can start, but Richard can finish.
Okay. All right. Well, you're a team.
George Lukes is known as one of the eight, or the Ashcan School. And in the early 20th century, to be a member of the Ashcan School was not a particularly flattering name to be given. And the thought was that coming out of the 19th century, artists were painting things that were nice. They were painting beautiful landscapes and lovely portraits and still life. And the artists who were associated with Robert Henry and the group that they called themselves, the Eight, at the Macbeth Gallery in New York, came from a background in illustration. And they were more interested in representing things that dealt with everyday life. And so work was something that was interesting. Urbanization was interesting, immigration, different cultures, all kinds of things that were considered kind of rough. And so Lukes was part of that group. But he had come from the northeastern Pennsylvania coal regions, but particularly the southern end of that in the Shenandoah area. And so he had gone back in the 20s and done some work down there, and a set of images and a large mural that was installed in a hotel initially, and now is over at the Penn State Schuylkill campus. But he had exhibited there as well. I mean, he did work in preparation for a New York show, but he had exhibited at the Pottsville Public Library. So Richard knows this part.
Yes, Richard, tell us more.
I don't know how I found out about them in the first place. The drawings were there, but they are there. He left them there when he did his summer visit and his painting project in 1925. It was in the summer. And in that fall, which would have been in November, he did have a show of his coal subjects. And the title was Lukes Paints the Land of the Anthracite Land, or Land of the Anthracite. And it was at the Frank Wren Gallery in New York City in 25. There was quite a number of works that were on display. For some, I believe he was raised for a while. I believe it was Shenandoah. And there's a little bit of controversy about some of the data on him. Well, he was that kind of a person because he referred to himself as Lusty Lukes, Chicago Whitey, that he was a barroom fighter, and so on. Gene Tunney was a personal friend of his. That was the heavyweight champion of the world. But he came to the anthracite coal region again and again. In 1921, he came and did paintings of the coal miners and so on. He came in 23 and did more work. He came in 25. The last year was in 27, in which he was commissioned to do that great mural, the Nico Allen mural, which is preserved there. That was done in 27. And thereafter, he did not return to the coal regions. And he continued to paint. Of all the artists that we have covered, in my opinion, he is acknowledged by authorities, historians, galleries, and so on. He's prominent. He was prominent, and so on. And his work is in many private and public collections. Not only the anthracite, but he did many subjects, quite a few different subjects. But he would have been fun to be with, though, as long as you got along with him, because he was quite a personality, which is, he kind of shows that in some of the photographs that were taken of him. He had a sad ending. It's controversial, but they did find him in 1933 in New York City in one of the doorways, slumped over, and he was dead. And they couldn't quite determine what was the cause of that. So in respect of him, I think they mentioned it was something like a heart attack, but it might have been a little bit more of that because of his nature and how he would behave in a tavern. And it was 1933, and that's it.
There is a really beautiful quote well, I don't know if Luke's would want it to be a beautiful quote, but it's a good quote that he had in relation to the work that he was doing representing the miners. "You know, these friends of mine, the miners, are the greatest individuals in the world. Strong without fear, they leave their homes each morning with no established certainty that they will return to their wives and children that night. They've come to live in the proximity of danger, and they accept the hazards of their work. Through this constant living with danger, a part and parcel of mysticism has come into their minds."
Well, if I could add to that, this is during the 1930s, and it was during the bootleg problems in the Southern coalfield. Quote, "A newspaper reporter noted the bootlegger's courage and resilience when he wrote, 'Anyone who knows them knows it will be dangerous to use force against them. These men are accustomed to bitter, hard work in which the threats of injury and death are constantly over them. Familiarity with danger has bred fear out of them.'" They were fearless. They were.
You brought some images with you, and here's a miner who looks fearless, who looks fearsome, actually.
Miner's Head by a female artist, Blanche Grahams. Susan Teller knew her personally, and she said, "You couldn't have met a nicer woman." She said, "She was so gracious." She said, "What a talented, gifted artist." And this was done in 37, I believe, and it's a complicated technique, aquatint etching, and it's a very large plate. This is a very coveted print, very difficult to get, and it's in major museum collections. And it's haunting in a sense, because perhaps the most haunting of the graphics of the 1930s. And it's interesting that she did it in Lansford, and when she went there with other artists, and they were sponsored by Harry Sternberg, who received, I believe it was a Guggenheim grant to go and do work on the coal industry, later in the Pittsburgh on the steel industry. And this came out of that. And there was a very fine article done on her life. It was very professionally done by Weschler, and it was in Print Quarterly. And I have studied that article as well. So I'm actually pleased to say this. This is in my collection. I was able to acquire one. And I'm not going to tell you the cost. But keep in mind, though, just for all of us right here, and that is this, there is the buying and selling. There is the auctions. There's the hunt and the chase. And that's what's kept me going over this particular subject. But I was very fortunate to get an original copy of this.
Darlene, describe it, the image.
Well, it's dark, for starters, very dark. And when you do a print, there are different ways to do it. But the idea is that there's a plate with ink on it, and it's removed from certain areas with different techniques. But for the most part, this is black. And it's a very large head, sort of a circular shape of the helmet. And then off to the lower corner, you see a close-up of the highlighted areas of the face, so the eyes and kind of the cheekbones and the nose, and then the rest falls into darkness. But above the eyes and in the center of that sort of circular area that would be the dark helmet, there's something very functional. A miner would wear a lamp on his hat. But it's represented by Grahams as almost a galaxy. It's spiraling. It's this spiral of stars or something. So almost like stars in a cave or some sort of thing. So there's a very ominous kind of quality to it, but there's also, again, something mystical sort of in the way that Luke's is suggesting that might be part of what comes from working underground so often and so long. So that is definitely one of the haunting images.
She didn't pull that plate, that print. A professional technician, a master printer, did it at the New York City workshop. And they did approximately 25. Then there were proofs, and the artist was allowed to keep 3 or 4 prints for their own use. But you'd have to be a highly trained printer to pull it because it's so large and so complicated.
There seems to me, at least anyway, with printmaking and this idea of the anthracite industry, there's something very tactile about it. And so Michael Gallagher, who was an artist who came out of the Scranton area, was an illustrator and a printmaker, but was working with something called the carborundum print, where grit was kind of ground into metal, and there's the feeling of something rough and scraping and texture. And then paper is soft like skin.
And wet.
There's this idea that there's something hard and something pushing against it that's somehow similar to that idea of a human figure pushing and mining against stone. It seems like a really good medium.
And if I might add, it's magical. It really is to see a printer in a printing workshop. And when it passes through the plate with the ink and the paper and it goes through the rollers, and then for them to pull it up and you see an image, it's almost like magic. It is.
Chester,
what have you got there?
Well, I have a really special image. It's entitled The Driver Boy. And this was done by William James Harris. He was born in 1868. He died in 1940. It's a photographic postcard about 1900, and it's from Richard's collection. And I wanted to read a quote that's in the catalog. This was noted by Homer Greene in his book, Coal in the Coal Mines, 1898. One afternoon, I chanced to be in a certain mine with the fire boss. We were standing in a passage used by mules to enter and exit underground. In the distance, we heard a clattering of hoofs growing louder as it came nearer. And as we stepped aside, a mule went dashing by with a boy lying close on his back. The flame from the little lamp on the boy's cap, just a tiny backward streak of blue that gave no light. They appeared from the intense darkness and had disappeared into it again, almost while one could draw a breath. I looked at the fire boss inquiringly. "Oh, that's all right," he said. "They've got through work, and now they're going out. And the mule is in just as much of a hurry as the boys is." "But the danger," I suggested, "of racing at such a speed through narrow, winding passages and almost total darkness." "Oh," he replied, "that beast knows the way out just as well as I do, and he can find it as easy as if he were set every inch of it, and I don't know but what he can. Anyway, the boy ain't afraid if the mule ain't afraid."
No. That particular postcard is rare. I've never seen it for sale, and I was very fortunate to get it from a private collector. I think he said he found it in an album in an attic. So it was preserved, you know, and it's a delightful, it's a very strong image of a youth making his way in life a long time ago. It's about from 1898, 1899, roughly that era it was taken by W.J. Harris.
And Darlene, what do you have?
I have two small paintings by Corwin Linson, who was a friend of John Willard Rott. So we talk about Rott a lot, but Linson was a longtime colleague and friend of Rott's. They shared a studio, I guess, at one point in New York City. And then Linson would often come to visit Rott. He was known for doing illustration. So actually, illustration is kind of a big component in the show, and that idea of newspaper reportage and journalism. But Rott would also paint out of doors. That was part of his French training. And Linson did as well. So there are a few little, I measured them just for framing purposes the other day. So they're about 12 inches square. They're small. And they would have been done in plein air, in the open air. And they represent these views of coal breakers and the trains coming and going in front of them and the smoke kind of changing. And so they're very active with this loose brushwork and this really lush color. They were painted at a time when there was strike activity starting to happen. And so they have names like Battle and Struggle for Life. Another one is called Poison. So I think there's a conversation sometimes about, with the anthracite industry and representations of it, how early did an awareness of the environmental effects of that start to kind of emerge? And clearly, like, Linson knew it. Linson could see maybe, I mean, certainly the environmental stuff, the idea of a poisoned kind of landscape. But Struggle for Life or Battle, that could be an environmental sort of thing, or it could also be related to the labor difficulties that were happening at the time. And it was a difficult job. So part of that idea, again, with the illustration, kind of getting back to that side of it, was to chronicle that stuff and that idea of those everyday kind of occurrences and how that was playing out.
Dr. Darlene Miller-Lanning, director of the Hope Horn Gallery at the University of Scranton, Richard Stanislaus, artist, collector, and guest curator of the exhibition we have been talking about, and Chester Colesa, retired historic site administrator of the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission, Anthracite Heritage Museum, and Scranton Iron Furnaces, and guest essayist for the catalog of this show. The show in question is titled The Anthracite Coal Industry of Northeastern Pennsylvania, selected paintings, sculptures, and works on paper from public and private collections 1829 through 1959. The show opened on October 20th and will run through December 12th. And there will be two public programs as well. This Friday, October 24th, a talk titled Fine Art Images of the Anthracite Coal Industry of Northeastern Pennsylvania, a gallery lecture by Richard Stanislaus, guest curator and our guest today at the Brennan Hall Pern Auditorium at 5 o'clock on the campus. And then a reception will follow at the Hope Horn Gallery from 6 to 8 p.m. That's the opening reception and gallery talk. Then Friday, November 7th, a talk titled New Deal Post Office Murals in the Anthracite Regions of Northeastern Pennsylvania, a gallery lecture by David Lembeck, New Deal Scholar, and that's also in Pern Auditorium of Brennan Hall at 5 o'clock with a reception at the Hope Horn Gallery, and that's from 6 to 8 p.m. For more information on the web, scranton.edu, scranton.edu. Now that's the fall exhibition with this theme, and then there will be a second part to this exhibition under the Anthracite Coal Industry of Northeastern Pennsylvania theme, and that will open February 2nd and run into March. And that is selected prints, drawings, and watercolors from the Stanislaus Collection, 1933 through 1946. But this show is part one and will continue through December 12th, and you're invited to the opening reception and lecture on Friday, October 24th. And for details, scranton.edu, scranton.edu. We had a full hour-long conversation with our three guests about part one of the exhibition, and we shared part one of that conversation with you today, and we will have a second installment of the conversation to come.